Welcome to Health Hats, learning on the journey towards best health. I'm Danny Van Leeuwen, a two-legged, cisgender, old white man of privilege living in a food oasis who can afford many hats and knows a little bit about a lot of healthcare and a lot about very little. Most people wear hats one at a time, but I wear them all at once. We will listen and learn about what it takes to adjust to life's realities in the awesome circus of healthcare. Let's make some sense of all of this. In 1997, I participated in my first Patient Family Advisory Council. I convened the member panel as Director of Quality Management for a managed care company. We set up a provider or clinician advisory panel at the same time. My boss, the executive director, was psyched. The panel started as a show-and-tell platform for us leaders. Actually, it was kind of boring. The turning point came when both panels wanted to talk about the pre-authorization process. Managed care companies often need to pre-approve a block of visits before they pay. Frustrating for clinicians and members, expensive for the company, and time-consuming for everyone. As a result, the managed care company changed practice to pre-approve 7 visits without pre-authorization. We dealt with overutilization on the back end. What that means is if providers appeared to provide services that didn't seem medically necessary, we dealt with those clinicians. We stopped making it harder for all the rest. I've led many patient family advisor panels since then, some window dressing and some meaningful. I invited James Harrison to join us to talk about his study of patient family advisors. James and I met through PCORI, the Patient-Centered Research Outcomes Institute. Our favorite topics include making health choices and engagement of academia and hospitals with patient family advisors. Our mutual favorite question was so what and variations on that. Does it matter? Is it meaningful? Who does it serve? James Harrison's career is focused on research and quality improvement efforts that seek to improve the delivery and experiences of healthcare for people who have been hospitalized. He joined the University of California, San Francisco, UCSF, Division of Hospital Medicine in 2012, and he's an assistant professor of medicine. Before UCSF, James was based in the Surgical Outcomes Research Center at the University of Sydney and the Royal Prince Alfred Hospital in Australia. It was in Sydney that James completed his Master's of Public Health and his PhD. James, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate you taking the time. We've known each other a while. We've been on many projects together, and we make it a practice that when we could travel, we got together pretty often. That means a lot to me. You're one of my go-to people when I realize I have no idea what I'm talking about, and I need somebody to give me a reality check. You're very good for that, so thank you.
Thanks, Danny.
Yeah.
It's interesting you say that. Because you're my reality check, too.
Well, good. That works. So, James, how do you introduce yourself in a social situation?
I'm James Harrison. I'm a researcher, lives in San Francisco. I'm born in Britain. I'm also lucky to have an Australian passport, too. Lots of influences on who I am.
Mm-hmm.
Professionally, assistant professor at the University of California, San Francisco. My research focus is around creating age-friendly care transitions for older adults leaving the hospital, but then also, which is kind of how we connect, is, you know, trying to work out how we do this thing, patient stakeholder engagement in research.
I'd like to focus our conversation about patient and caregiver engagement. We think about research, especially research that informs collaborative decisions that people make with their clinical team. One of the reasons you're one of my go-to people is that you've had varied experience and varied dilemmas in the challenge of patient and caregiver engagement in research. You've tried out different approaches. Some of them have worked well, some of them haven't worked so well, but I really like that you're constantly trying it out and learning and then trying something different and adapting it to whatever the situation that you happen to be in. Can you talk about your evolution of like that interest? Like, how did you get here?
It was actually through attending the first PCORI meeting, and one of the people I met was you and some mm-hmm. other people. And this whole idea of doing patient and caregiver engagement in research was new to the sense that it wasn't community-based participatory research. It was this, okay, clinical research, health services research, other types of research, but trying to bring in the patient and family member. And I was like, well, of course this makes sense. Like the light bulb went on and was like, of course this makes sense. But then as a researcher and everything that I, most of the, this is the lens I bring to this conversation. We weren't taught how to do this when we did my training. Patients and caregivers were research subjects or participants. Yeah, I could interview them as part of a study, or do a survey, observe people or so on. Wouldn't know the first thing about how to engage them as partners in the research process. And, you know, that's where PCORI and then other, like through PCORI, various kind of advocates, stakeholders really opened my eyes to this. It was like, okay, this can be done. And the story I tell when I first started to do this with some advisors at UCSF, I was like, look, I've not done this before. And they were like, well, nor have we. So we kind of started this journey together. But then now I kind of conceptualize there's various three kind of buckets of how I think about engagement. There's for the kind of individual researcher level, then there's kind of at the department level or the specialty level. I work in hospital medicine, so thinking about hospital medicine as a field. And then I think at the institutional level, so say at UCSF, an academic medical center. I've been fortunate through some of my own efforts, but also working with some other amazing people, been able to have these opportunities to, as you say, look at different ways of engaging patients and families. Do you want me to go through the various different explain
yeah,
more
yeah,
what
yeah,
I mean
yeah,
about
yeah.
those there?
Please, yeah.
So like, again, at the individual researcher level, I've been fortunate to be involved in the development of two patient and family advisory councils, one for hospital medicine at UCSF, but then one for, it's called Home Run, the Hospital Medicine Reengineering Network, which is a network of hospital medicine researchers who have been working together for about a decade. And then about 5 years ago, kind of I got involved and we were kind of talking, we need to get the patient voice in what we're doing. How can we improve hospital care without talking to patients and their families? So again, we created this advisory council for this network, which I've been fortunate enough to be able to access for my research, but it's kind of used, both of these forums are used by investigators, faculty, staff, leaders from both UCSF and this hospital medicine research network to come and kind of get their input on projects. It's built capacity for hospital medicine as a field for researchers to kind of come to these PFACs.
Okay. PFAC, patient family advisory councils. Yeah.
And that is just one model. It's not perfect. Mm-hmm. One of the big criticisms is, well, you've not got representative people. They're only a small selection. There are ways around that. And we've mm-hmm. done some work with my PFAC of exploring that, like done research on how do you do research PFACs. Mm-hmm. I've been really lucky. These PFACs, have, as I say, you've got your project, you either go for a consultation or you get the PFAC works with you throughout the whole process. But flipping that, thinking bigger, I've been really lucky that I'm part of an acronym, you know, and I've had to write this down. It's the Accelerating Systematic Stakeholder Patient and Institutional Research Engagement, so a SPARC. And it's led by Tung Nguyen, Paula Fleischer, Nainika Palmer, Erica Wong from UCSF, and then community organizations and representatives such as Monique Lasser from the Rafiki Coalition. And this is an amazing group, which I'm on the board for Aspire, which I kind of was pulled into. This group is kind of thinking about, at an institutional level, how does a big, complex place such as UCSF or an academic medical center do this kind of work? How do they have the infrastructure and the systems in place that researchers can partner with patients, families, and community members? Mm-hmm. And it's been great. On one hand, Aspire, through, you know, outreach and talking to researchers, it's highlighted they have challenges finding patients to partner with. They need training in how to do it, mm-hmm. and how to do engagement. Also, they need support in how do they kind of nurture and sustain these relationships. But I think the mind-blowing thing for me has been actually and us working with community members about research engagement. And I think this is the Aspire group will tell their story, so I don't want to steal their thunder, but I just want to take my hats off, because the quick summary is the community said, look, yeah, research engagement's important, but hold your horses. We've got a lot of other things we need to talk about first. We need to talk about the lack of trust we have with large health systems. We've got to talk about health equity. We've got to talk about, you know, how you're always coming to us asking for input. How about you do something for us? You listen to us. So it's highlighted that even before we can get to this engagement about research, we've got to level the playing fields with these community groups we're working with. So anyway, mm-hmm. That's a long way of
Yeah, saying, no, that's, you know, very interesting. You're talking about how partnering with these community and patient groups has maybe reprioritized or reoriented the way of thinking about the trust, the equity. Do you find that there's an issue with the established institutions being able to integrate and actually change anything with the input that they get?
Thinking of those two levels, on an individual project level, without a doubt. People come to the patient and caregiver stakeholders and be asking about, do these questions resonate? Are these important to you? And then that feedback can really shape what the project is. We've had through Home Run, that network, there was a COVID grant we put in, and we kind of spoke to the advisors and said, well, what outcomes are most important to you? And it was those outcomes that they thought were most important that we prioritized. All the things about looking at patient-facing materials, making sure that they are relevant, can be read, are understood. Yeah. So I think on an individual researcher level, yes. I think when you talk about institutions, they're a bit more, as we know, they're larger, they're more complex.
Right.
And I think...
I mean, doctors have a hard time changing them.
But I think there's a mood for change. Maybe I'm being optimistic. Mm. The fact that it is increasingly recognized across the board that this kind of engagement is good, not just for research, but for so many different things, building trust, building relationships, help both parties. You know, it helps the institution, but it also helps the community as well. Mm-hmm. That said, it's not easy. How do you compensate patients and caregivers? That mechanism isn't there, but I think there are ways, and I think slowly but surely it's happening. And I think with some of these engagement awards, the PCORI Fund and then other foundations fund as well, about trying to work out how at system level we can make these changes. Mm-hmm. I think it is going to change.
your practice is in acute care, so hospitalization. How does the community around, like, obviously everybody who comes into the hospital comes from home, whatever they consider home. They go back into the communities. The institution life is just a drop in the bucket. And so how does your, how does that work with your advisors in terms of broadening the scope beyond the walls of the institution into the communities that they come from and go back to?
Okay, that's a big question. So I'm a researcher. I'm not a clinician, but right. My research, I'm like kind of embedded in the health system. Mm-hmm. I would say we're lucky in hospital medicine, in fact, that it is that generalist unit. So you get all comers. When you're admitted to the hospital, the chances are you're going to see a hospitalist. So in terms of diagnoses, in terms of backgrounds, you're going to see a lot of different people. And yet, as you say, it's just this, hopefully, just a very small part of your healthcare journey that you're in a hospital. So definitely there's challenges to recruiting people, to try and identify people. We've got our processes in place for that. But I think we all have to, how we approach it is, look, at some point, unfortunately, most people are going to be hospitalized.
Mm-hmm.
And we need, and it is such a, whereas it's a normal environment for those that work there, for patients and caregivers and members of the community, it is not. One of my friends and colleagues who is a patient advisor, she just was like, Gina Simzak, she was like, this is not normal. You think it's all normal? This is not, because it's a completely foreign environment.
Mm-hmm.
It's that kind of background where we can, I think people are very willing to participate and get involved.
Mm-hmm.
Still for our institutional PFAC, so Patient and Family Advisory Council, it's still very much that model of people come to us for meetings. Obviously now they're Zoom meetings. I think for the Home Run Network, which is, as I say, this national network, we've got people from all over the place that are on this PFAC. So, you know, they've all been hospitalized. They've all cared for someone that's hospitalized,
mm-hmm.
in various different settings. So they bring those different perspectives. But after their meetings, they go back to their communities, mm-hmm. however community is defined, to not only share what is going on in the research world, but their role in what we're doing, but also they're back in their communities, living, learning, and kind mm-hmm. of then bringing that lived experience back to us.
So what kinds of decisions, clinical decisions, health decisions, are people making as they are returning home? People who get admitted to a hospital, you know, obviously the largest proportion of people go to the hospital are probably there for maternity. From there, it's probably joint, orthopedics type, you know, cardiac and chronic illness. I don't know. I made that up. But, you know, I'm probably not that far off. They're going home. Going to the hospital is such an interruption. Something drastic happened, and so they went to the hospital. So then they're going to go home, and they're going to face something really different, whether it's a period of recovery or it's a change in. How does that, preparing for those kind, the decisions that people, like as a nurse, we thought of a discharge plan, and I always thought that was a little bizarre, because like, first of all, it's I don't mean bizarre. Let me start over. It's like either the discharge plan should have started the day somebody was admitted, or it's a life plan, not really a discharge plan. It's like what's happening next in your life. And so how does the having engagement with patients and caregivers. Does that influence that kind of process? And if it does, how does it?
Another way to consider this discharge plan, yes, you're right, it should start at the day of admission, but also thinking it's a recovery plan, really,
yeah,
as well, when you think about it. So there's engagement with those decisions, and there's two types of engagement I see here. There's that around, as a patient, you're engaged with your healthcare team in developing that recovery plan. So okay, you're comfortable sharing your views, or your care team invites you to share your views. So you kind of have this shared decision-making approach to mm-hmm. your recovery plan, where you're thinking about, well, what are your goals? What are your aspirations for when you get home? What do you think are going to be the challenges? Mm-hmm. Again, we know this. The hospitals are great at focusing on the medical problems and the disease problems, but maybe not thinking about, well, how are you going to get your groceries when you get home? How are you mm-hmm. going to get up and down your stairs? Mm-hmm. How are you going to get out of bed? And I must say, now moving, as I have done, into kind of the geriatric space of the focus, it's about how are you going to live independently?
Mm-hmm.
So that's engagement on the patient perspective when you're sitting in the hospital. But I think from the research engagement perspective, mm-hmm. it's through working with advisors and as partners who have been able to share that, look, despite all these grand plans of shared decision-making, having a recovery plan, they're like, that ain't happening. That's mm-hmm. not happening. And they've been able to identify from their perspectives where the pain points are.
Okay.
And then enabled us then to say, well, okay, we need to do something about that.
Give me an example of a pain point.
Big one in hospital medicine. And this maybe not have this impacts on the whole healthcare experience in the hospital. Patients like, well, what's a hospitalist? I don't know what a hospitalist is. We've been told that over and over again. And my colleagues who are hospitalists and were around when it was first kind of coined about 20 years ago, actually by the chair of medicine at UCSF, Robert Wachter. And been around a long time, patients still are like, well, what is a hospitalist? How is this person different to my primary care provider? Mm. And there's confusion there that we've been told about, and that impacts on everything, because who is this person that's leading my team? Even the concept of a team. My colleagues, as I say, that were around at the beginning of the hospital medicine journey are kind of going, wow, we're back there again. Okay. And I think other things we've learned is, you know, all the simple things. Was involved in the IHOPE study. So it was improving hospital outcomes through patient engagement.
Hothouse study? IHOPE, yeah. I was there. Yeah.
This was with the researchers from across the country, hospital medicine, and we partnered with 37 stakeholder groups from across the country, patients, caregivers, provider groups, mm-hmm. research groups. And the idea was to find out what were the pain points of being hospitalized, or more importantly, what are the top priorities to improve hospitalization? As a researcher, I was so excited about this, thinking we are going to get these topics no one's ever heard of, and then we are going to be able to go and do research, change, and have such a big impact. And also, you know, everyone's going to want to fund us, because we're going to get these things no one's ever heard of. Most humbling experience ever. What were the top things we found? We want shared decision-making. Patients want to participate in decisions about their healthcare. We already knew that. We're obviously not doing it. I want to know who to call when I go home after I've been in hospital. One of the, you would think, the most simplest things that we've been trying to address, having phone numbers for patients to call. Obviously, we're not doing that well. Preparing patients for discharge to home or for a skilled nursing facility. People are saying, I don't understand what's going on. We've been trying to do that for years. Obviously, we're not doing it right. So it was through this engagement, as we identified all these problems, which we already knew were problems,
Mm-hmm.
We thought we were addressing them.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, well, we're not. And as I say, humbled by this.
Yeah.
Talking to people, that said, I still, we didn't find these unique novel priorities that no one had ever heard of, but the fact that we identified the ones that we did really needs, it pushed that, or it's pushing all of us to think, well, okay, we need to go back to basics.
Yeah.
Now a word about our sponsor, Abridge. Use Abridge to record your doctor visit. Push the big pink button and record the conversation. Read the transcript or listen to clips when you get home. Check out the app at abridge.com. ABRIDGE.com. Or download it on the Apple App Store or Google Play Store. Record your healthcare conversations. Let me know how it went.
In the clinical decision-making worlds that I operate in, there's this real push to computerize, you know, to technology assist, computer-assisted decision-making. You and I have probably talked about this 10 times over the years. Well, maybe I'm exaggerating, maybe 5 times, but more than once. It's the human and then the then thinking about, can this be scaled through computerization? When you're thinking about some of these things that you've been talking about, like just who is everybody, what are phone numbers, is that stuff that lends itself to technology assist, or is that just very human, just fundamentally human?
I think in an ideal world, it's a bit of both, that the technology can support that human element, particularly in San Francisco, you know, Silicon Valley's down the road. Everyone's like, there's an app for that. We can solve it all with an app. And as I say, I think that can support a lot of these problems. But the feedback we get from people is, we need the person to sit down with us and say who they are, explain who they are.
Yeah.
So I think they have to complement each other.
Okay.
Technology is great, and it really can, it does help in so many of these problems that we have in healthcare. But I think for a lot of the stuff I deal with and work in about patient experience, you really do need that human element added to it.
When I worked at Boston Children's, I led their patient family experience initiative. One of the more interesting projects that I saw there came out of the emergency department, where people were inventorying community services. When people were being discharged either from the hospital or the emergency department, that there was this library that was, you know, sort of app accessed of services. And it was a lot of work because things are always changing. And, you know, you can't
keep them updated.
You got to keep it up. People are making, when they go home, are often more about their life than their medical treatment.
Which makes it hard because the health system's geared to teach, it's set up to focus on those medical problems, not so much maybe the life, social concerns. So there's that tension for sure. I think that example you gave of the community resources, and I think, you know, technology definitely can play a role, but I think one of the things that I think is really important that we need to think about more is how do we implement these things in real world practices? We can have these apps, decision support tools, research evidence that all work in theory, which in research studies, which of course you need that evidence. But then how do you get people to use them on the busy floor if you're a provider or if you're a sick person in a hospital bed. I sometimes think to myself, I'm not sure if we need to invent anything else. We've probably got all the answers out there. We just need to know how to implement these things. And, you know, there, as you know, there's this whole implementation science. It's about how do we work out and determine the best methods to implement these tools. And a lot of that is through engagement. It's through working with patients, families, providers, health systems, talking to them, looking at workflows, and seeing, you know, how we can get these embedded in real life settings.
I've become more and more aware of the mismatch between the questions people have about their health, their medical care, their life, and the evidence and the tools. There's a mismatch. Sometimes I think that these tools are developed, but they're not addressing what people are trying to deal with. So there's no getting people to use them because they don't necessarily serve a purpose to people.
Which is why you need to talk to your stakeholders at the beginning when you're developing these things to make sure it's going to be impactful, relevant. We're preaching to the choir here because you and I both have these similar views on this. But, and as much as I say, I'm very hopeful that this, the world is changing to think more like this. There's still a big proportion of, you know, academic medicine and research that doesn't think this way, which is why, you know, there's people like you doing all what you're doing to get that message out. So we may be in the choir, but we've got to keep singing to all the people that don't hear this or understand this. So.
I did ask you to look into one of the gigs I have is working with AHRQ and the MITRE Corporation on the CDS Connect, and which is a repository of computable clinical guidelines. And I, one of the things I had asked you is, do you, are you aware of it? And if you are, what do you think? And if you're not, would you look at it? Give me your 2 cents worth.
So I didn't know about it before you'd sent kind of the email. That said, I'm not a clinician.
Okay.
I think it's probably a great research resource too to find out about current guidelines, but also I saw there were some tools in there like decision aids and decision support tools and so on, which I thought could be really useful for as a patient, as a researcher, or as a clinician. But my question back to you, and it links to our previous discussion, how do we implement these? How do we get people to use them? They've obviously been evaluated and they work. They're, if they're guidelines, some of them are based on, you know, evidence. What's the step about how do you get people to use that information in their practice?
Well, I think that's a good question on several levels. Like my angle on it has been that there are the traditional people who are working on clinician use of that. And I think about how do patient caregiver influencers, how do patient caregiver decision makers, so whether they're a family decision maker or a pod decision maker or an organization decision maker, are these decision aids useful to people who represent larger groups of people? So I think about how does that fit in life flow, you know, as opposed to clinician workflow. And pretty much it doesn't. That's really a challenge because it's fairly remote. And if we're stuck at the clinician workflow, well then the layperson, the knowledgeable layperson, I don't want to say it like that, but you know what I mean. People who are already familiar with healthcare systems and already familiar with research, how they can use it. it's funny because I've been involved in this for many years, and in my gut, this is really important. Like, I personally think that the first step in improving anything is to have an inventory of what's available, like an inventory of what is. That's what you start for. And then you can do a gap analysis, and then you can guide it in a good direction. And so I really appreciate the idea of a repository, because then there it is. It's like a library. You go look. But is it a library of stuff that matters to people? I don't know if I'm saying of that right.
No, I'd say it matters to you if you have the condition or the illness that it's trying to kind of help with. And I think you mentioned there about the workflows, and I think part of this, going back to the implementation aspect, is yes, we need to work out getting it into doctors' workflows, but it's also how do we engage and empower patients and caregivers to use this, information, so they can, one, access it, to understand it, but then also when they're with their care provider, go, okay, how do we use this together?
Yeah.
Again, I hope it's not just this overly optimistic view of medicine, but I would hope that's what we're trying to achieve here.
Well, that's an interesting point, because I know that, for example, so you know I have MS, and so when I have seen the neurologist and I use chiropractic and acupuncture and massage and meditation, and the neurologist will say, well, I have patients that use that stuff. I personally don't know that much about it, but I'm into anything that works for my patients, so tell me more. And I feel like, okay, so that is an opening. And then, you know, I can then bring in my perspective or the research that I've done, and then they'll help me put it in context. Like, they'll say, well, this, and this is good, but this is contraindicated with over-the-counter thing. And they'll say, no, this interferes with that, you know? So it's like we explore together. And so from that point of view, so that's, you know, when I go in and I feel like I'm more knowledgeable, then I can motivate or, you know, a conversation that's a lot richer and helps me get closer to where I want to get. But I'm not any kind of example. You know, I'm an out there. Yeah. I'm an out there patient. I'm intelligent and I'm a pain in the ass. And sometimes I think my clinicians tolerate me and sometimes they appreciate me. But it depends.
You raise the elephant in the room with a lot of the engagement and advocacy work that we both do, is it's always thinking about, well, you're not going to get the be totally generalizable or representative of everybody, but we've always got to be asking those questions, because you're very health literate. You're a pain in the ass. You will speak up when something's not sitting right with you, but a lot of people won't.
Right.
Thinking about engagement, how do we encourage that engagement from people that aren't as comfortable or familiar with the health system to participate in these decisions, use these support tools that you've spoken about,
mm-hmm.
at the opening, feel comfortable that to mention to their provider, what about this? Because as you say, it's important to know that if some of the things you're doing, if they're contraindications to something that the doctor's prescribing you or suggesting for you. So I think we've always got to be mindful of that we need a kind of, with the work we're doing around engagement, is to really give voice to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
How can we support everybody so that they can be involved in the decision making, whether it be around their own healthcare or about a research study?
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much. This is great. I appreciate it. Mm-hmm.
Another signature win with patient family advisors occurred later in my career and resulted in a major aha for the long-term care organization I worked for. I was sharing recent survey results with the PFAC. The survey consisted of standard questions with Likert scale responses. Likert scale is like 1 to 5. You know, rate something by 1 to 5. We were underwhelmed with the survey results, and we hoped the PFAC would help us improve the survey scores. Instead, the PFAC complained that unexpected, unannounced changes in key direct care staff upset patients and families. They had relationships with the staff, and suddenly they were gone. No notice, no explanation. It never occurred to us. Easy fix for us to communicate better. 3 months later, survey scores across all questions improved. In my experience, brilliance is simple. Treat others as you wish to be treated. Sounds simple. 8 words serve as the cornerstone of many religions, certainly a North Star for me. Simple, but wildly difficult to do. Drink water, exercise every day, foster good sleep. I call them magic levers for good health. Again, simple and tough to do. I love that James aims high and keeps coming back to basics. Listen, build trust, foster health equity, communicate understandably, start inclusion early. James is a learning machine. He knows that the basics don't come easy and they never go away. They require vigilance and perseverance. Thank you, my friend. Good chat as always. Onward. See the show notes, previous podcasts, and other resources on my website, www.health-hats.com/pod. Please subscribe or contribute. If you like it, share it. Thanks. See you around the block.